allowing utilities to recover more costs from customers, expanding the Don't Say Gay bill, plus adding voter ID to absentee voting, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 24th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb signed a bill into law that could undo the effect of an Indiana Supreme Court decision over Duke Energy's coal ash waste. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports language allowing utilities to recover unexpected costs from their customers was put into the bill just 8 days ago.
The cost to comply with federal rules on coal ash cleanup ended up being more expensive than Duke Energy thought. So even though it had already budgeted for those costs, the utility asked the state if it could raise rates in 2019. The Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission approved the increase, but the state Supreme Court ruled it retroactive rate-making, which is illegal. But Republican Representative Ed Soliday says the court should have deferred to the agency. He authored a major amendment to the bill, similar to one he proposed in the House. The new law lets utilities recover those extra costs from complying with federal rules without having to get pre-approval first, as long as the IURC approves them after the fact. Consumer advocates worry this will mean higher electric bills for Indiana residents and businesses. Soliday says there are 5 cases pending before the agency that could be impacted by the law, but exactly how the IURC will respond isn't clear right now.
Are lawmakers taking a balanced approach between utilities and consumers? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and O'Shea Boyd, public engagement editor for the Indianapolis Star. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, this bill essentially gives ultimate deference to the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission. Isn't that where it should be?
Look, let's get something straight, okay? The supermajority of Republicans in the legislature has always been controlled by the utility companies, and it still is. Okay? This bill is a mistake. When you have issues, first of all, this isn't an emergency. The coal ash has been accumulating for decades, okay? The regulations come down. The way to handle this is use the expertise of the Utility Regulatory Commission up front and have public hearings on what's the most economically sensible approach and what's the most environmentally sensible approach. Not a retroactive, well, we spent more than we had when we planned on this way, and also you need to make us whole. I mean, that defeats the purpose of using the expertise of the Utility Regulatory Commission. And it's another example of the fact that the supermajority is controlled in this state by those utilities. I don't think this is a good bill. I don't think this puts the interests of the consumers ahead of the utilities, or even to balance it. It gives preference to the utilities, to whatever bad decision they made that costs so much, the consumers are going to have to pay for.
I'm not going to say a bad decision that they made, but I mean, this was they had planned. I mean, this is federal law says they have to get rid of this stuff. They laid out a plan for the IURC to do it, and then it ended up costing more than they had originally planned. Is it right that they get to go back and say, oops, we got to charge our consumers more?
I think what Chairman Soliday argued in front of the Senate Utilities Committee yesterday on a similar issue is that absent that, you're just guessing. And so forget that it's coal ash and forget that it's Duke. It just so happened to be Duke and the coal ash mandate that came from the federal government that Duke had to comply with. It could have been any utility or any similar federal mandate. And so when the federal mandate statute passed, when we didn't have supermajorities, by the way.
Still have been controlled, whether it's supermajorities or not.
We were in the majority, but we didn't have supermajorities.
Okay.
When the federal mandate bill passed, it intended what Senate Bill 9 tries to reestablish, which is the legislative intent of recovering not just the actual the action that the mandate is requiring, but the planning to present it to the IURC, whether those are legal fees or engineering fees or other things. And that was always the intent of the legislature from the time. The Supreme Court said the law doesn't allow that. And so this is a fix to do that. And there's been arguments that we shouldn't do this when there's pending litigation. There's always pending litigation, right? In this situation, that's a fine policy of the legislature when in other situations. there is endless, constant litigation in these in these rate
and
decisions,
know,
and that's on purpose
right.
by the people that are opposed to this.
You can never know the intent of the legislature.
I
never know that.
Well,
you
the legislature
fill it in after the fact.
Well, the court can't take that into account.
Right.
No, but you're saying that the reason they have to go back and change it because that was the original intent.
This is
you
what,
can't know that.
Of course we can, because that's
no,
how the of course we can. That's how the industry was reacting. That's how the industry was operating. And then they were sued, and then the Supreme Court said no, the law doesn't allow it, and now we're clarifying so the law does.
I want to ask about a separate part of the bill. This is as I pointed out in the lead. This was just added 8 days ago, and that's interesting. but I want to actually ask about the original bill, which kind of goes the other way in that it says what we're starting to see from utility companies is, well, we're seeing from a lot of utility companies that they are retiring coal-fired power plants. That's the way the industry is going. Well, some of them are trying to retire them sooner than they originally planned, and they are facing higher costs as a result of that. And what the legislature is now saying is, you can't get those costs back from consumers, which would appear to be, when I talked about at the top, is there balance between utilities and consumers? That feels more balanced in favor of the consumer, but is it?
You know, whenever you talk about these kinds of issues, this is a multi-tier proposition. On the surface, and you can pick whether you want level one, level two, or level three to talk about. You know, we just talked about one. You can talk about another issue, which is simply, forget the clout, for instance, of publicly held utilities, electrical providers. There's a cloud also still in the state of coal mines and coal producers, operators. That's a powerful force. Yes, there is an environmental sustainability force too, but probably not as well healed. Not as well healed, and certainly doesn't have the traditional kind of clout historically is what we've seen. So there's so many levels here to this, and I'm not sure which one we even want to address. But clearly, you could say that this bill is balanced and that it's one is a victory for consumers, if you want to construe it that way, and another part of the bill is a victory for, these power companies. But that, I think, doesn't do justice to just how nuanced this bill. In the end, this state has been kind to its utilities, and perhaps for good reason. They want stable, reliable sources of energy. And it seems that that pattern is continuing, despite this. The first part of the bill, let's say, the original intent.
Yeah, I want to talk one more time about the original part of the bill, because it does get to, it seems like generally Republicans in the State House say, well, the utilities know what they're doing, let's let them do whatever they're doing, except when it comes to retiring coal plants, which the legislature has been pushing back against for a while, and this is the latest step in doing that. It's not saying you can't, but it's saying if you do and it costs you more money, we're not going to let you recover those costs from your consumers. Is that pro-consumer or is it anti-environment? Or is it honestly a little bit of both?
It's probably a little bit of both. I think it's fair. I'm going to look at this as a consumer, as a ratepayer. All that policy stuff, it matters, but to me, the regular electric user, pay my bill, get my bill, I don't care about all that stuff, right? I just want to know if my bill going up and why.
Or the lights turning on.
Yes.
That's the rate.
And that's all I really care about. So the argument, as a consumer, the argument is it going to benefit me? And it seems like, from the consumer's perspective, it's going to benefit the electric companies. And we are held captive by these companies, as we know, because you only have one company you can go to for your power. You don't get to choose. So then I have to just suck it up and pay whatever it's paying. If it's saying I got to go back and pay, they're going to recoup the cost, I have to pay that or I don't have power. There's not a lot of us who are going off the grid. There's a lot of this talk out there, but that's not really happening. That's not really feasible, right? Yeah. So it seems like there can never be this actual, can we do all the levels? Can we actually take care of all the levels at once? Do we have to attack one level at a time? Yeah. Can we care about the environment? Can we care about the consumer? Can we, you know, have the company, the electric company, Duke Energy, who happens to be what we're talking about now, can they still sustain and be in Indiana and operate? How do we make all these things work? And we never seem to have everything working together.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, do you think the Indiana General Assembly is doing enough to address rising utility bills? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, should Indiana put cameras in highway construction zones that are used to give motorists speeding tickets? 80% of you say yes, just 20% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. 80-20 was like pretty much the spread of the vote in the House on that bill. Republican lawmakers passed a controversial bill out of a Senate committee this week that requires teachers to notify parents if students request a name, title, or pronoun change in the classroom. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Violet Comer-Weiland reports the amended legislation also addresses other issues under the banner of parents' rights.
The amended bill would require teachers to tell parents if a student requests to change their name or pronouns, including nicknames and changes that are not related to gender expression. The bill was amended to protect teachers from being penalized if they refuse to use a child's requested name or pronoun out of religious conviction. Many that testified expressed confusion about this change, including Senator Shelley Yoder, who said her religion would convince her to go against the law and use the changed names and pronouns children request.
I have a deeply held religious conviction to see children in their full humanity.
The bill maintains its restrictions on teaching human sexuality, extending the limitation from pre-kindergarten up until third grade. The bill now heads to the full Senate.
Mike O'Brien, if you went to a teacher and said, I want to be called Mike instead of Michael, which I imagine is a conversation you might have had once in your life, that teacher now has to get parental consent. Does this bill make sense at this point?
Well, if you want to reduce it to its most ridiculous application.
That's the bill.
I look at this two ways. One, you listen to the LGBT community in their testimony, and you're outing these kids. These kids are going to trusted adults in their life, and you're outing these kids, and that puts them at risk. It puts them in danger. On the other hand, as a parent, I look at this. I've got two teenagers. I've been and a 10-year-old, and I've been very, since they were young, like 10, 11, 12 years old, I've been like very proactive about being sex positive and having an open conversation, thinking that if you sow those seeds early on, then you're, you know, I'm not explaining sex to my daughter when she's on her way out the door to prom, you know, and like that's the situation I don't want to be in. But if my daughter, son, for whatever reason, went to somebody in the school and said, I'm having real questions or I'm really struggling with, or they overhear him or her talking to a friend, and then they harm themselves, and I didn't know, when I could have like rallied the resources and been there and part of that, rounded out the other half of that conversation where their life is in part at school and in part at home, I'd be furious that I didn't know that. Because I think the presumption in this conversation is that we got to protect these kids from their hillbilly dads who are going to go beat the hell out of them when they go home and say I'm gay. So I struggle with where to be on this bill other than maybe the school's the best. Maybe all the people involved who understand the dynamics in a more colorful way, in a more dynamic way, what's the added, they know the parents, so they know, if my kid goes to a school counselor and has that conversation, they go, what do you think your dad would think of that? They go, well, I talked to my dad about a lot of things. I think he'd be fine. Well, then I encourage you to go talk to your dad, right? But maybe the place to be is you can't legislate any of that. You can't legislate that conversation or the reactions systemically through that.
I think there is, Mike just articulated, I think, a genuine push and pull here. Mm-hmm. I don't know that everybody involved in backing this bill has that same genuine reasoning behind it. but I think there is a genuine, like, we want parents to be involved a lot of times, not in every case, but a lot of times we need parents to be involved.
Absolutely.
For these kids to be as healthy as they can.
Right.
How do you legislate that?
You can't legislate it. Mike's point is exactly right. You have teachers or counselors who presumably know the child and have some experience with the family and will know to say to the child, you need to have that discussion with your parents about this or whether it's risky for the child. They'll know that. Mm-hmm. And legislating it is just another example of the Republicans trying to have a group of people they can beat up on to fire up their base to show that they're really tough on gays and they're tough on transgender and they can bully them. And it's senseless. You can't legislate this. You know, either the parents have a good relationship with the child or they don't, okay? And I find it difficult to believe that you get a child to the teenage years with responsible parents that don't have some idea about what's going on, okay? It's obvious And they'll know that. And if they're responsible parents, they'll deal with it. And if they're not responsible parents, you're exposing those kids to risk just for political advantage.
I want to talk about the change that was made to this bill in the Senate committee, in that the original bill said the same parental notification stuff, if a kid goes to the teacher and says, I want you to call me by this name instead or by this pronoun instead. But it was only parental notification if that change was because of something that differed from the gender they were born with. So it was clearly targeted at transgender youth. Mm-hmm. This does not target transgender youth as explicitly, but it opens it up to these sort of ridiculous scenarios. So is it better that it doesn't target trans kids, but at the same time we're going to send a note home every time Johnny wants to be John or Jay or J-Dog?
It's just stupid because it is targeting trans kids in a way that we're going to get around it and not say it explicitly. Mm-hmm. That's the trick, right? So that you can out these kids or you can and we have this line. This is not an easy, we shouldn't legislate this. I mean, we've already said it. It's not an easy thing for parents. It's not an easy thing for schools. As a parent, I would want to know what's going on with my child. I wouldn't want someone knowing about what's going on with my child, and I don't. And I would feel offended if you knew and you didn't tell me. But not every parent situation and child situation is the same. Not every kid is safe at home. And that's what they're not thinking about, is the safety of these kids. And that's what's appalling. And it's very anti-trans. Like, why are you trying to bully this group, like you said? Why you want to bully these kids? They're kids. They are kids. So to your point, though, and I'm sorry, I kind of went off.
No, that's fine.
But to your point, it is a way to get around, because how many of us have gone to school and had a peer say, don't call me Samantha, call me Sam. So now it's Sam. Are we saying that's...
Yeah, well, it's any change.
It just seems, though, that, I mean, the notion of self-identification or how you want others to refer to you is an odd distinction. What separates that from a checklist that says what kind of gaze is your student looking at males or females? Is there a way, an interesting walk, or is there some suspicious behavior of clothing or a rainbow button, or did somebody seem to be standing too close by somebody else at the lockers? I mean, mm-hmm. What a name is one thing, but when do we get into the realm of behavioral sorts of things?
24.
Where we say that. One other wrinkle I will introduce that perhaps we haven't talked about here, but it's been litigated in other states where if you say, I want to be referred to by this pronoun that doesn't happen to align with my birth gender, my biological birth gender, courts have found that the professors, and this was litigated at a post-secondary level, so keep that in mind.
A little different.
Don't have to heed the child's call to be used for that, because that may offend the religious sensibilities of the academician who wants to still refer to Samantha as Samantha.
And that's in this bill, too, but is, you know, and I think Shelley Yoder raised an interesting point, which is, well, that's some religions, and there are other people whose religions tell them that they're going to call that kid what that kid wants to be called. I don't care what the parent says.
How does that offend me by calling you what you want to be called?
Understandably,
the legislature, the Republican part of the legislature, is reacting to the sheer volume of this. The volume of kids identifying as transgender
which is still a real number, but it's more than it's ever been.
On the other hand, it's also pretty confusing to sexually at 14 and 15, 16 years old, or 43. it's hard to be a teenager coming of age that way, but it's also never been more okay to go, I don't really know how I feel, you know, and openly have those conversations.
Yes.
In society, it's not perfect, but it's trending. And the legislature is trying to get it. The legislature is trying to put that back in the box. I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, as a comedian sarcastically referred to a lot of this slate of bills, not here in Indiana, but nationwide. You know, it's just these transgender kids in public schools have had it too good for too long.
Yeah.
All right, Senate committee rejected an effort this week to allow anyone to vote absentee by mail in Indiana. The rejection came as a bill to add greater voter ID requirements to vote by mail headed to the full Senate. The bill requires voters who mail in an application to vote by mail to include either their driver's license, state ID, or voting ID number, or a photocopy of a photo ID they can use for voting. Republican Representative Tim Wesko says his bill simply extends voter ID requirements used for in-person voting to voting by mail.
I've long felt that the process of simply matching signatures as the means of verifying the authenticity of an absentee ballot application is insufficient and extremely subjective.
Democrats object, saying Wesko's bill creates an unnecessary hurdle. But Senator J.D. Ford says if they're going to add this requirement, then vote by mail should be open to everyone. He proposed an amendment to eliminate the excuses needed to cast a mail-in ballot.
Essentially, I'm just asking why the government needs to know.
Republicans on the Senate Elections Committee rejected Ford's proposal without explanation.
John Schwann, in a state that's been doing voter ID laws longer than most states in the country, since Indiana was a model, does it make sense to apply the voter ID law to absentee ballots?
If the question is there an argument that somehow contains some logic, I guess you could say yes. I mean, since 2005, and this was litigated, Indiana was one of the first. In fact, it was a test case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I guess one could argue, and I've heard it argued, yes, treat it the same, because everybody gets one vote, you're casting a ballot. All right, but again, this is sort of like the first issue we talked about, multiple layers. Is this really about that, or is this simply an attempt to dissuade or discourage certain people from voting? And the argument there, of course, is that it might be more difficult for individuals with limited income, who have disabilities, who are older, or have some sort of incapacity to get the necessary ID, or to make sure that it's, you know, all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. That's another argument. Again, we could have two entirely different arguments.
Wait, the reason is to depress the vote, okay? There's never been a voter fraud
in
an absentee ballot
in Indiana.
I'm not
saying that's not the reason.
It's not your turn, though.
I don't care. That's the reason.
I'm simply, if you're trying to extend the logical argument, whether that's really what's at heart here.
It's not logical.
Because if you go to the average voter and say, listen, when you go to vote in person, you got to show your ID. If you're casting a ballot by mail, you should have to prove somehow, whether it's with a photocopy of your ID or putting one of these numbers on your application, you should have to do that. I think the average voter hears that and goes, yeah, okay, what's wrong with that? Isn't that the selling point here, that it seems to make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you're going to make it across the board and remove all the other stipulations for absentee ballots, I think voters will be okay with that. I don't think, even though that we know there's this nefarious plot out here to suppress the vote.
This is why we're down the
bottom. But I think people will be fine with that because voters care. We don't want voter fraud. We want to go ahead and prove, yes, I have the right to vote. So if I show my ID when I go to the poll, why can't I just go ahead and put my ID number in there and make it convenient? Because now you're making it convenient for me as well, so I don't have to even go anyplace now.
Well, you can't all vote by absentee, though.
Well, I think you get rid of all the stipulations that are there now.
Oh, JD Ford.
Yes. So I agree with that point.
If let's say this bill becomes law, as I expect it will, if the next step is opening vote by mail to anyone, is that the right way this should be done?
I'd be fine with that if they would ever do it, but they're not going to do it. I mean, it's not by accident that Indiana ranks 48th or 49th in voter turnout. It has been a plot by the Republican majorities for years to depress the... It has. We don't make it easy to vote. We keep it at 6 o'clock at night. You have to have an excuse to vote absentee. No. You have to have the ID, whether you have to go to the BMV to get one or not. All of those things are designed, not huge numbers, but enough to make a difference.
Some Republicans in the General Assembly aren't shy about this. They don't want vote by mail. They want to encourage, at least, voting in person. Is that the way that Indiana voters want it to go?
I've done a lot of things in politics and Republican politics over 2 decades, run governor's races, run statewide campaigns, run local races. I've only ever had a get out the vote strategy. I've never had a keep the vote in strategy.
That's where I'm like, get out the
where
vote
I'm, where I'm shooting for, if we can get it down to 16% turnout, we're going to be okay. That's not a conversation that's conscious. But I also don't have a home on election policy from a party standpoint. I'm for what you both talked about. I'm for, let's make it really easy to vote absentee. Get rid of all these absurd, I'm going to be out of the, you know, we can vote for 30 days, but now I got to verify I'm going to be out of the, I'm not going to be home on election day, yeah. And I'm lying, basically, right? So pull all that back. I've not had a problem with vote, but I've also not had a problem with voter ID laws. And making this consistent, I think, makes sense. I also don't have a problem with automatic registration, or everybody can vote by...
Are you sure you're a Republican? Greg
Walker's just on the board.
I'm looking at all of them going, I agree with everybody. Yeah. I agree with voter ID. I agree with auto registration. I agree with make it easy to vote by mail. Like, get all this out of the way. There's ways to secure the system that open it up, too.
It feels like going back to the idea that O'Shea talked about on our first topic, which was, can't we do a little bit of everything for everybody?
That assumes that you want to do something.
That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and O'Shea Boyd, the public engagement editor for the Indianapolis Star. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wafyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.